We'll encounter a monster today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wee.
And I'm Don Wooten. Katie James had an encounter with a monster. We'll hear about it on Scribble. Had an ominous sound to it, didn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
I love it.
Yeah, boy. I think that's called hyping, isn't it?
Well, and as long as one survives the monster, you can chuckle about it later. But you
absolutely.
Know,
so.
Yeah, but that's, you know, we read your essay in These Interesting Times and thought, got to talk to Katie about this.
Oh.
Because this is interesting. The whole article is good. But how did you happen to get involved with this project?
Well, I've known about Midwest Writing Center, and I always wanted to become involved. But I think that just life was so busy. And then with the pandemic and the shutdowns and quarantine, that afforded a little more time for me to actually sit and write. And when I saw the project and how it was more focused on the pandemic specifically, as well as the derecho had some pieces in there too, I think, wow, we've all been through such a turbulent year. So I really feel like I can add to this anthology.
Had you done any writing prior to this?
A little bit I had. I did not grow up writing. I wasn't involved in high school with any type of clubs or extracurricular activities for writing or journalism. But when I went to college, I took a creative nonfiction course, and that really sparked my interest in writing about real life. Mm-hmm. And from there, I would just write essays and submit for local collegiate conversation,
sure.
To have scholarships and whatnot, and workshopping and the like. And so I really got into it at that point. And then I wrote the essay when I saw it, but nothing really big time like some of your other guests, I'm sure. I listened to some prior episodes and thought, oof, they're pretty distinguished.
Everybody's at such different stages, you know.
Yeah. We've talked to published authors. We've talked to those who haven't published anything.
Yeah, or didn't start writing until they were in their 70s.
This compulsion to write, I don't understand it. Well, I do a lot of writing, and
right.
I complain
yes.
about it every day.
Yes, it's a cumbersome task for sure to yeah. actually sit down and put pen to paper, and now
yeah.
your fingers to the keyboard. And so that's what I was really happy about. If you could find a silver lining in the pandemic, mm-hmm. was that we could actually sit, and I think emotions were high, and people
yeah.
just needed an outlet. And yeah. this book, this collection, really provided that for so many local writers.
Yeah. Well,
what I like about the book is it fleshed out all kinds of writers that we didn't know about.
Right. It's true. It brought people to writing as, you know, kind of traumatic and joyful, but kind of extreme emotional experiences.
Absolutely.
Tend to bring people to the need to write in a way that if everything's going fine, you don't. You
absolutely.
Know.
You know, but it's true. People have used that. Harry Truman, we've cited him before, he had a volatile temper. And when something hit him the wrong way, he'd sit down and write a fiery letter.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Then put it in an envelope, address it, put it in the outbox, and his assistant would pick it up, read it, and throw it away.
Yeah.
That's so interesting because I think yeah. with social media playing such a large part in our lives, people will take to Facebook or Twitter
uh-huh.
and they'll type out those really fiery updates and status posts, and then they'll delete, delete, delete before anyone can see it, or they'll post it and
yeah.
then quickly
yeah.
delete it. And so I think that thank goodness for social media, because that's how I found out about this
mm-hmm.
Need for writers to submit. And so, you know, it's a double-edged sword, but mm-hmm. Harry Truman and I have that in common.
I personally think that the internet ought to have a 24-hour pause on it. So when you write those crazy things,
you can come back later and look at it.
Wait a minute. Did I really mean that? Is that, wait a minute.
Yeah, email changed everything because in that sort of mood or temperament, you could type something and send it and, you know, no pause, and it's only sped up. You know, it's only moving faster and faster.
It is.
How long did it take you to write your contribution?
Probably about 15 minutes. I was in one of those moods.
Really?
Yes. There was a lot going on in my life in 2020. And to just sit down, I kind of knew, and I had discussed where the beginning of my monster had started. And so I had it in my mind originally. Uh-huh. And it just came to a fever pitch in 2020. And so I used that and I just sat feverishly writing probably around 11:30 at night while my son was asleep. And then I got it done, took a break. You know, a few days later, I came back and I re-looked at it and I edited it and then I sent it in.
Good for you.
Thank you. Yeah. This is my first time being published, so I was super excited about it.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And often, you know, people are too, well, I speak for myself, sort of insecure when the thing's out there and it sits and you never send it anywhere and then you sort of forget about it. So excellent. Good for you to just do it and go for it.
Well, I've been rejected a few times, so it's not my first time trying. It's just my first time accepting it.
You're not an official writer until you've been rejected. My writing students
are definitely.
That, you know?
I'll talk about insecurity. My editor is so tired of me writing, well, I'm not sure about this, or this is
I think that's why we write, exactly as you said. You're trying to work something out. You're trying to make sense of something, survive your pain, whatever it is, find language for things we don't have language for, and, you know.
I love that. That is absolutely true, and I think that this book shows that. I think it shows that we, as a Quad City family, so to speak, came together and put pen to paper, and hopefully people that weren't published in the book or pick it up and they read it and didn't even know about it prior to think, wow, someone did experience what I experienced.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, some of us do it just to fill the space, but that's altogether other.
Well, Katie, everyone's waiting to hear about the monster, right?
I'll say, read to us, please.
So the piece is called The Monster Inside. I ran as long as I could from the monster. I wore gloves, changed and washed face masks as if they were underwear, and disinfected as if my life depended on it because it felt like my life depended on it. The silver lining is that I was ready. I had been preparing for this for almost 20 years. When I was 10 years old, I fell down a short flight of stairs as I was exiting a ride at our local fair. The ride itself wasn't even that bad. It was the one where people all sit facing the same direction, and then you lift up and are jolted around in a rectangular motion. I wasn't dizzy, nauseous, or traumatized from what took place during that minute in my life while I was thrashed about by the giant mechanism. It was the split second it took to fall down the metal stairs that did change my life. I remember seeing my grandparents standing at the bottom, waiting for my cousins and I to come down and move on to the next fun experience of the day. It was the third step that caused my foot to somehow slide out from under me. My other foot followed, and the back of my head slammed against the platform. Everything went black, and while I don't remember that I lost consciousness, it took a few seconds to register the sunlight beaming down on me as onlookers, my cousins, and my grandparents frantically came to my aid. They helped me to my feet and walked me to a table where I sat with my family for a minute to collect myself. I wiped away the few tears that fell in embarrassment as if I hadn't just sailed down the steps in a calamity. I was 10 years old, it was a hot summer day, and I was at the fair. There was fun to be had, and a little spill wasn't going to stop me. Like a valiant little phoenix rising from the ashes, it was time for the tilt-a-whirl. Now, I'm no brain expert, so I can't definitively say that the fall impacted the rest of my life, but within 24 hours after the fall, something happened to me. A grenade in my psyche exploded. There was life before this, and then life after. There are such events as these throughout time in our lives that mark a change in which we know we can never return to how things were in the past, no matter how badly we might wish to. The way I operated and functioned was forever altered, and even though eventually my life began to resemble how it was before, carefree and happy, there is always that lingering fear that my mental state will succumb to fragility and thrust me back into the feeling of being a scared, lonely 10-year-old girl. Before my fall, I had beginner's knowledge of germs. I knew you wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the bathroom, and after romping in the dirt to flush germs down the drain. It was just routine, something one did out of habit. After my fall, it became something I did out of compulsion. I can't pinpoint the correlation between falling down some stairs and feverishly burning the flesh of my hands with scalding hot water, but there had to be something that caused this, right? The timing was just too coincidental. I became preoccupied with germs as these visible, tangible monsters I could see all over the place. Everything was contaminated, and therefore, if I touched it, I was contaminated. If I was contaminated, I would require disinfecting. If I didn't do what I could do to keep myself clean, not only was I in danger, but so were my loved ones. Obviously, this is irrational, but tell that to a child. The week after the fall, I was taken to the hospital after a panic attack, and then to numerous therapists and psychiatrists who were expected to put my psyche back together. They diagnosed me with obsessive-compulsive disorder and prescribed medications in doses high enough to treat full-grown adults. It helped keep my OCD at bay, but left me completely numb to emotion. The monster inside was kept quiet, but it was still there. As I grew into an adult, each time I thought I had myself going through a tough time, I remembered to feel grateful I wasn't going through the despair I experienced as a child. To this day, those 6 months after the fair were the darkest period in my life. A large factor in coping with my OCD was rationalizing that this affliction was inside my head, telling myself it wasn't real. As long as I remembered it wasn't real, I would be okay. But then there was a monster outside of my body, and slowly it crept closer to home.
That's really something. I mean, how do you feel about self-revelation like that? Does it bother you, or are you comfortable with it?
You know, I thought about that before I came here. I was like, this is a really honest piece about something mm-hmm. very tough that I went through as a child. And I think that it's critical to talk about mental health and these yeah. moments in your life when you realize that it's not okay and you're not okay. And that's why with the pandemic, I think a lot of people shifted the way that they viewed the stigma about mental health. And mm-hmm. I thought, this is going to be fine if I put this part of myself out there. I want people to see that. And if you're experiencing something similar, to know that you're not alone. And yeah. so I'm completely fine with it. And I teach students that are in junior high, and this is where I think they're starting to come into periods where they're going through mental struggles and they're conflicted with, mm-hmm. is this appropriate of me to feel this way and be open, or do I keep it inside? And I want my students to understand that you need to seek help when you need it.
Yeah.
But the advent of coronavirus must have been something to stop you cold.
I had to really think about how I was going to function through the rest of it. I thought to myself, if I go out in public, what am I going to do? I don't know if you guys have seen the pictures of people on the internet that would wear, you know, full body suits. And yeah. I'm like, that's not about to be me. I can do what I can do that's practical and rational. And so it was a lot of self-talk and interrupting that compulsion to do more than what was really necessary.
I think we all, I mean, because we were sort of building the plane while it was already flying,
absolutely.
You know, there was this sense of, I remember the first time I'd read what we were supposed to do at the grocery store, and when we brought groceries back, you know, leave it on your porch, scrub everything.
Right.
And I consulted family and friends and said, is this over the top, or do we really have to do this? And nobody knew for sure. I mean, mm-hmm. We got a lot of advice, medical advice, that yes, you had to go through these steps. And it's interesting to think back to the start of it.
I think it's, and the scientists took a lot of criticism because they couldn't tell you exactly what was happening.
Yeah.
But I thought, let's be reasonable, folks. Nobody has seen this before.
Yeah. Yep.
Nobody knows how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing we can do is just follow the procedures they used 100 years ago. Put on a mask, keep your distance.
Mm-hmm.
And any rational person, I think, would do that.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of irrationality going on at that time.
Well, definitely. Lots of different fears and paranoias and belief systems that people come out of that, you know, all sort of came together. And, you know, you felt this. I remember going to the grocery store and sort of the tension between the people who had masks on and those who didn't.
Yes,
you know, you were sort of looking at each other like, oh, you know, you shouldn't be in here. And the look that you'd get from someone who was unmasked, like, don't you tell me.
Absolutely right.
It was amazing, though, because back in 1918, when the flu hit and nobody knew how to deal with that, everyone wore masks without question.
Yeah.
They just did.
Yeah.
Because that's the best thing we can do, and so let's do it. But now people are resistant to doing things that you would think are normal. It's true, when you put on a mask, you think, I'm not going to be able to breathe here.
Yeah.
But then you think, well, wait, doctors wear these for hours at a time.
Yes. And I think people found a lot of compassion for other walks of life. You know, when the schools shut down and parents had their children at home all the time, I think that they started to step into the teacher's world and think, oh, my goodness, what am I doing and how do they do it?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I totally thought, wow, people wear these all day long.
And the doctors and the nurses and the hospital staff that had just grooves in their faces. From the hours that they had to wear those masks and take care of other people.
Absolutely.
Many who didn't want a mask. And you think, whoa, how that must have felt to be trying to save the life of someone who...
You're being super careful and others are being completely careless.
Yeah.
And even now, we're not out of the woods.
No,
we don't know for sure what's going to happen.
No, I know.
And as one who has had COVID and has experienced some of the results of long COVID, and I wonder, what is that going to amount to going forward? Because I really don't know.
Right?
Absolutely. And I'm not the same person I was before I had COVID. I have the long-lasting effects as well. When I caught it in October of the last year, I had it bad, and I was not able to go to work for 3 weeks, and breathing hurt, and your head pounded, and then it seems like you don't fully recover. You keep getting sick very easily, myself and my son, and so that monster eventually invaded my body, so to speak, and it felt like this tangible thing that you stare in the face, and so it was really quite scary. What's going to happen? I didn't know, because I found out I was infected before I felt any of the effects.
Before you felt it.
And then within a couple of days, I'm like, whoa, I can't move.
Yeah.
You know, constant sickness, and you have to monitor your oxygen. It was really quite trying. It was scary.
It's scary enough for adults, but to have my kids are older, and I remember thinking, thank goodness I don't have a really young kid, because I would be a mess just on behalf of the child. You know,
that must have brought your childhood back with a bang.
Oh, you know, at that point, you know, my husband had already had it long before. And so I felt like I've had enough exposure to how to function with this. I know how to keep other people safe. We just stay away. We stay inside.
Yep.
You know, if we have to order our groceries delivered to our porch, they leave them there. This new way of living, I was like, it's okay. We're just going to amp it up a little bit. But then once the sickness really set in, my son is a very busy child, and he had no symptoms, thank goodness.
Yeah.
He was doing great with it. But I thought, oh, I'm definitely going to need a team approach here. And thank goodness my husband was able to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's so uneven and unfair. For example, I caught COVID, and I think either I got it from Roald or he got it from me. I think we got it together.
Yeah.
He died in 5 days.
Oh, my goodness.
I lost 15 pounds, and that was it.
Yeah.
I had no effects at all. Yeah. And I'm an old guy. I'm one of those that's susceptible.
Yeah.
And I figured, what is this stuff? Why is it? It hits somebody so hard and others so lightly, but you're still infected and you're still spreading the stuff, so you've got to be careful.
It's equal opportunity.
Yeah, and there were so many erratic you know, there was the 101-year-old woman wheeled out of the hospital sort of waving, yeah. going, yeah, I made it, you know, it wasn't that bad. And a 35-year-old SEAL, you know, who flattened and yeah. hadn't been sick before. And we think, why? I don't think we have answers for that. You know,
no.
why? We might never get them.
Mm-hmm.
But you're thankful for the ones that make it out, and then you grieve the ones that you lost. And
yep.
so that's all we can do, I think, as a society. We might never get the why.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I focused on with this. I had lost my dad during that time, and I had, it was the first wave of COVID.
Did he have COVID? Is that, or you don't?
Not to our knowledge.
Yeah.
We were told it was a no, but we saw the front lines of the medical practices
sure.
and how they had to be careful, and only they didn't let everyone in the room.
Of
so,
course.
You yeah. know, we went through the grieving process during COVID.
Yeah.
And still trying to be careful. We couldn't have the funeral that my father deserved because he was a wonderful, beautiful man.
Yeah.
And he deserved a lot more. And so there was just so much going on. It was so turbulent.
Yeah.
But, you know, what can you do?
Well, you wrote.
And I did.
I think that's remarkable and
you.
Important. And
what was the effect for you psychologically when you had written this, when you'd gotten it out of yourself and onto paper?
A lot of tears.
Yeah.
You know, you go back through
yeah.
what it was like to live in those few days, those few weeks, the months. I remember thinking at the beginning, I hope this only lasts for a couple of weeks. I can't go through this for months, years,
yeah.
2 years later. So when I got it all out, I just thought, wow, I feel better. I feel like I put my own mental illness in perspective in juxtaposition with
mm-hmm.
this illness and affliction outside of our bodies. I just thought that it came together, and I just felt like a little bit complete.
Yeah.
Whereas I had felt empty for so long due to the impact of the pandemic on life and losing my dad. So it felt like I was kind of being restored back to the best version of myself eventually.
Well, and I think, didn't you say something in the piece about just the phenomenon of not, when COVID hit, not being so alone with whatever it is you're struggling with, you know, suddenly
yeah.
everybody's struggling, and it might be with different reactions, different responses, but yeah, with the whole
yeah.
globe, you know.
Absolutely. We learned so much about ourselves and each other at that time
mm-hmm.
where someone may have struggled with being secluded, and if you didn't know that you struggled with that, now you had to be faced with it. Maybe
yeah.
you realized, wow, I don't like this either.
Yeah.
We all put a foot in each other's worlds, so to speak,
yeah.
and felt what we all struggle with independently. Now we're able to understand what each other goes through better, I believe.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
there were people who couldn't face it and just pretended it wasn't there.
Well, yeah, we always
yeah,
have that.
People
yeah.
just escape from reality. I think we live in a society where it's easy to escape from reality. Television,
yeah.
Someone said, I know it's true, I saw it on television, and having worked in television in the early days, I can tell you, no, not
yeah.
at all.
Yeah.
It's artifice. It all is. There are some live things. Newscasts are pretty well straightforward, but almost all programming, especially the reality shows. There's
yeah,
nothing real
right.
about them at all.
Yeah.
It's all scripted.
Yep.
People just, I don't know.
Well.
So now that you've done this, that you've written this, are you going to do any more writing?
I am. And, you know, right now I'm in the process of just taking notes, making outlines, because
mm-hmm.
the one project that I have that is closer to my heart than anything ever will be is my story of my son's experience with autism.
Sure.
So that is something that is continuously in the works. The story is not done. It won't
yeah.
ever be done.
Yeah.
But it'll come to a point where we will know what Hunter's life with autism will look like, more finite than what it is now.
Yeah.
And so it's just making sure I have dates and names, and then journaling what I feel in some moments,
mm-hmm.
the most raw, visceral moments as a parent of a child with autism
yeah.
in a world that is becoming more aware and accepting of accommodations necessary for individuals with autism.
Yeah.
I am in the works of it. I am going to call it Beautiful Boy. Mm-hmm. One family's trials and triumphs and faith throughout autism. And so in several years, hopefully, it gets picked up for publication because I want others to know this is what I went through. And it's just one story, but you might find a piece of it that's important to you and gives you hope.
Yeah.
You know, what is interesting is the spread of autism. Mm-hmm. We're not really sure why. And sometimes I think, you know, to say that you're on the autism spectrum, just a little touch or a lot and so on.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes my habit of constantly repeating things to myself, that sounds autistic. And maybe I was had a touch of that myself. It's hard to say.
Something that you can go in and out of, though, because you...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
When I find myself endlessly counting, I think, wait a minute, this is ridiculous.
Well, and we're not handed a baseline when we enter this world of this is normal.
Yeah.
We are all on a spectrum
different
of criteria,
mm-hmm.
for sure. And so maybe we all have a touch of something that's different about us, but I know that that's what kind of makes us all unique and beautiful in our own way. And Hunter, especially my son, he's just a phenomenal. This child is my hero. He goes through so much. And so during the pandemic, you know, I found myself thinking, why with the pandemic? I also found myself thinking, why with the autism?
Yeah.
Well, I'll never get that answer.
Yeah.
And that's okay because I don't need it. Yeah. I have my son.
Yeah. Oh, that's a beautiful way to put it.
Yeah, so you have a project. Are you going to make a book out of this?
I absolutely will. Yep.
And that's a lot of writing, Katie.
It is. It's going to span childhood for sure up to 18. And hopefully someday Hunter's able to sit down and he can tell his own story.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to take that from him. It's my version of it was like to raise him. And I would love for him to tell his story someday.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll see that.
You know, when I hear about the things that you've endured in your life, that's got to help you as a teacher.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
I love my job. I'm a student support teacher.
Okay.
And I get to work with so many students on an individual basis, what they're going through. I have a lot of phenomenal mental health resources that I can link them up with and people that I work with that just put their heart and their soul in their work. And it is amazing to be able to help these students that really need us in ways that we never knew until they sit down in our office and they open up. And then we're able to get them to what might help them.
And it's a gift to for you to feel that as a gift, because there are a lot of us who wouldn't be able to handle that, wouldn't know what to do. I know we all learn on the job, I suppose, but you know, that's a hard age. That's a really tough age to ever, lots going on.
Oh, yeah.
So much. There's
junior,
lots of tears.
Junior high, that is tough.
Mm-hmm. Yep. People either want to go back to being a young child or maybe high school, but I never hear, I wish I could go back to junior high.
Well, no. I'll tell you, Katie, your students are lucky to have you.
Oh, well, thank you
and
so
you,
much.
You have made just marvelous use of your own life experiences. And
thank
I want
you.
To thank you for taking time to talk to us today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It was wonderful.
Katie James has been our guest today. And that'll do it for this edition of Scribble. I'm Don Wooten with Rebecca Wee. We're not going to quit, though. We'll be back next week, and we hope you will, too, for the next Scribble. Thank you.